I do want to point out that I would expect to have to tell McBain this, but if someone shares a file with you, it's in shared with me in your Google Drive.
Do you know how many things are shared with me? I can't dig.
Sort by latest.
Do both of you guys use Google Drive at work?
No.
Yeah, but not with this account. I have like we have like Google Drive for business or whatever, or Google Apps for business.
I'm jealous. We don't actually, our access to Google stuff like gets killed after like 10 seconds.
Well, you know, like what if Google just decides we're quote unquote fascist and shuts us down? Then what? How about free speech?
I know this pain. Sometimes it feels like I'm cantripping right into chains. No one can fix your head except for you. Don't let Agrodex run all over you. It just takes one blue and a fetch land. Is it really fair that one card can fix your whole hand? Oh, one day you're more gonna think that you're surely about to die. Your brainstorm's always there when you keep a bad hand, so no need to cry. Don't you know, causing change, things will go your way. If you hold your brainstorm for one more play. If you hold your brainstorm for one more play, things will go your way. Hold on for one more play.
Hello, welcome to the Canadian Threshold, the legacy podcast that's welcoming the year of Tin Fins. Jeff, have you ever resolved a shallow grave in your life?
In cube.
Did you screw it up in cube?
Have you ever stacked it wrong?
Stacked it wrong? Like you're discarding two cards and you're like, oh no, like not like this.
Right. You got the combo in your head and you're like, this doesn't matter. I'll just pitch these. Oh no. The hastiest, what's that stupid imp? You can discard a card. This is falling apart already.
Future Nymph?
Yes. Future discard my Future Nymph. Cast Shallow Grave. Oh, shit.
Not great. Jeff, how you doing?
Worse now that I completely stumbled on it. I was riding high.
Like, if people tune in for clean intros, they stop listening after, like, episode two.
We had a really good launch, though, until you passed it to me. I've totally dropped the baton here.
You know? It would be unfair of me to not say that I've dropped the baton. You know, I don't want to say every other episode, but most of them. On that note.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's why we have another arm to this.
As we've been fumbling back and forth, Brendan McBain has been waiting here patiently. McBain, how are you this evening?
I was waiting for you to just totally forget and just keep going. But I wasn't going to say anything, but I'm doing well. Fine year of the Tin Fins. So why is it the year of Tin Fins? Explain.
I was going to actually just see if people knew, but we can explain this. So Tin Fins, the full name of Tin Fins is Tin Fins Return of the Onion Burst 3. Is that right?
I think so.
And is a reference to the cartoon C-Lab 2021. We finally did it. We've escaped a year of Merit Lage, which felt like being frozen underwater for approximately 9 months. And I'm just patiently waiting in the graveyard to be reborn again. To be freed from my prison.
Maybe a shallow one.
You know, this is good. I think like when things open up, people get the vaccine. There are a few things that I enjoy in life more than drawing 14 cards. Sacking Children of Corlys, drawing 14 more cards, sacking Children of Corlys, drawing 14 more cards. But freedom from this pandemic will definitely be up there.
It'll be nice to get a children after this pandemic, to just get all that lost time back.
Are you actually going to sacrifice a child?
No comment.
If Jeff's not here next episode, you'll know why.
Without me.
I heard they organized the podcast on Parler. All right. We've made quite a mess, so why don't we get into some housekeeping? Jeff, I'm gonna pass it back to you.
Let me clean it up. I have housekeeping, real honest to goodness housekeeping. I'm back in business. Wizards, WotC themselves, are starting up God accounts again on January 13th. It's $25 and it lasts until the 27th. And this is happening for a set of super qualifiers that are all running throughout next week. So the important one for everybody on here is Thursday, January 21st at 7 o'clock in the morning Pacific. Not an ideal time, but we are the format that takes what we can get. So that's what we're left with. Now, I don't think there's any information out yet as to like what the general prize structure or anything looks like. If Eternal Weekend is any sign, it's going to be run exactly the same as a challenge. And I don't believe there's any art tied to this. And it looks like the top two people each qualify for the Kaldheim Championship, which is likely a standard tournament on Magic Arena, March 26th and 28th. But that part's not important. You just want the clout.
Standards are pretty good lately.
Maybe.
All about the clout.
Who's to say how it turns
overall
out?
There's been a lot of bans, I guess. I mean, that part's not good. I guess that's actually funny. I don't care about bans because I only play in Arena. And so it seemed good. I'm sure if you like bought cards, you're probably not super happy.
Well, the upside is that there's probably way less cards being sold for this current standard environment.
That's 100% true.
I
would imagine.
I wonder if they'll do God accounts on Arena for it, too. They did that for a different event, right? Because say you're, you know, an MTGO boomer and you qualify for this and you think, well, fuck it, I'm going to go play some standard historic. Like, there's a real cost to entry that, and you can't just buy cards. Like,
and you can't borrow either. Yep. Like, if it was MTGO, like, you know, if I had cards, I could lend them to you. I have lots of standard cards on Arena, but I could let you log to my account to practice, I guess.
Yeah, but I mean, even the actual thing. Yeah, I don't know. I'm sure they'll have some news closer to it. We got ages until then. And that's it. That's my housekeeping. There's literally nothing else happening.
That's a good one. I'm also off work. We're recording on the Tuesday, just for everyone's reference. So I'm off work tomorrow, which means I have some chores that I want to do and some errands I need to run. But I could also log in at 10 a.m. and purchase this token and immediately run a league.
I look forward to prefer chores and errands as like, I need to play this deck and go 5-0 with that deck.
Right. I got to get my, you know, necessary infect league run in before I go play some spicy things.
It's actually like a bunch of spice I want to try out. And there's only so many like paper days. So there are a few things I don't want to try. I have all the cards for test now.
That's exciting.
What was your last pickup?
Just Rite of Flames. I was waiting for the Rite of Flames to come in the mail.
Huh. And some decks don't even play them now.
I don't have a Taiga. I'm playing Bayou. So probably slight edge lost. If I get an Urza, I can play Bomberman and Urza Echoes.
Ooh, do you have a Gyarada?
Oh, I have a Japanese full art one.
Cyberclaw?
That I've used zero times.
Beautiful. I'm looking forward to the kind of like rejuvenation of Magic calling that happens when I get these God accounts.
It was a great mid-pandemic purchase. Or like beginning pandemic purchase. I'm like, I might need this Gyarada. Guess I'll order one from Haruya. It showed up after it was banned already. Because, like, you know, Haruya, obviously it takes a while for them to get the stuff here. Which is fair, but yeah, it just like comes in the mail. I'm like, awesome.
I'm sure that happened with a lot of people, especially with like Lurrus and things like that. Because like cards were out, the prices went up pretty quick. And then naturally people are like kind of like a little bit more hesitant to just snap it off. And then when they do, it's probably already banned at that point by the time it shows up. So,
oh yeah, it was broken on Magic Line before the paper ones existed.
Jeff, did you mention how long the God accounts go for?
I did, but I'll mention it again. It goes until the downtime on the 27th.
Okay. I honestly wasn't paying attention. So,
cool. Yeah, so $25 American, grumble, grumble. And that actually, I should mention this too, that token you get with it gets you in one of the qualifiers. And the God account doesn't go away when you redeem your token. So Magic Online looks really weird when you have it. Basically, when you have the God account, if you haven't done it before, you're just allowed to submit decks that contain cards you don't own. So if things look weird, don't worry about it. You can probably still submit and it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Man, now that I have the token, I'm like, should I play one of these?
There's like a sealed one.
No, there's not.
Is it not a limited one? There's a popper one on Saturday.
Oh, God. So that's horrible. Sorry.
It's for 20, players it's $25 for 2 weeks, basically.
Yeah.
For God account. And what is it, like $30 for a month if you're using some of these card services?
They're all leveled. You know, it depends. I have a pretty rental one with Card Hoarder, and I'm spending probably about $30 a month.
Right.
And so average one, like, if you don't have, like, you know, Force of Wills and stuff and you wanted to play, is probably closer to like $60.
Yeah. Yeah. I just, like, when I think about it, and like, if you considered kind of like spending a bit of money up front to pick up, like, you know, $150 or something like that, or you like know someone who has tickets and you trade them some real life cards and get a couple of like the really expensive cards or a whole bunch of the cheap stuff, and then get one of these services to rent out the big cards that might fluctuate or drop dramatically in prices, it's probably way better value. But my monkey brain also looks at it and is like, any card I want for 2 weeks? Oh my God, I'm going to sit down and just play the Super Nintendo for 2 weeks straight.
It is like a little bit of a convenience factor, right? Like, you have to return the cards or like worry about anything.
Yep, for
also,
sure.
We've talked about, like, I recognize I have a lack of self-control. And so not having access to cards all the time means I don't play too much Magic. Versus, like, if this pops up once in a while, I'm happy to spend, you know, $35 Canadian, gem a bunch of leagues over the next 2 weeks, and then be like, ah, I got my fix.
To me, that always comes back to, like, you're basically saying what my mom would say when we were growing up. And we didn't own, and we were not allowed to own any Nintendo systems or anything like that. And we would save up our allowance and rent one for a weekend and like not sleep. And then she'd be like, well, that's why we're never getting one, because you have no self-control and you'll just do it all the time. And we would say, if we had one, we wouldn't, because it would be there when we'd occasionally want to play it. And it was like one of those like chicken and egg things where we never did win in the end.
I'm sure it would like wane for me, but I still think I'd play more than I'd like to. And so
yeah,
this being like, this is like once in a while, it's like fine. But I don't have access to every card all the time. That wouldn't be good. I don't think
it's nice to have kind of a set time for it, because like just having a rental thing, you know, most of the time I will go through larger phases of like not really using it. And it's never like committing enough to like cancel it or pause it, because it's like, well, maybe I'll do something in a couple days. But I bet you, you know, more often than not, there's months where I'm just not getting any proper value out of this. So being able to like have something that's time gated is really like, all right, let's go, this is it.
Yeah, I'm really viewing it from like the business end for these companies, because it's kind of like this like gym membership thing where you're like, oh, I'm gonna get it because then I'm gonna be incentivized to use it every once in a while, but you just don't. And really what they should have, this kind of thing where it's like you buy the service for the month, and then once you've had it for like 7 or 8 months, your price drops quite a bit, and then you're just incentivized to just hold on to it forever because you don't want to kind of lose out on the deal that you have.
That's honestly, that's what ManaTrader says. Every month you stay, they like increase benefits for another thing.
Right. So, well, that's really smart.
Like your hours, you're allowed to have them go up. I think they got rid of that though. But like, you know, your rental range goes up. So I know Elliot, I think, just hung on to it for like a couple months because it was like, fuck, if I get rid of it now, I have to start all this over again.
Yeah, that's perfect. Like,
they're constrained by having to have the cards though, which is like,
yeah,
like there's a cost for them, mm-hmm. right? Versus like, if you have a gym and no one shows up, you already have the equipment. Like, I guess it's sort of the same, but
it's the gym equipment. That's all it is. Like,
plus, I mean, they really pick the right like consumers to hit with this. Like, Magic players losing up on that value,
Right? Oh, yeah.
Like, I can't quit my subscription even if I'm not using it.
And then at the same time, you can buy gym equipment for pennies on the dollar, stockpile it, and then it'll like increase randomly by like 1,000%. So yeah. I think there's all in all like a good incentive to have that stockpile. But anyway, we're totally diverting from what we wanted to talk about.
Instead of buying gym equipment, at the beginning of the pandemic, I bought one piece of jewelry, and that's worth like about twice as much now. So I feel like I did good.
Stocks, baby.
Stocks. Yeah, stocks. Buy magic cards. Speaking of magic cards, which is what we're typically here to talk about, we wanted to talk about a couple like relatively recent articles, I think. So I'm just going to tell you what they both are, and then we're going to go through them one by one. Rich Kelly wrote an article about how some of the heuristics of Brainstorm have kind of changed with like the power level of cards increasing. And then the one we're going to talk about first is Lawrence Harmon, he's written a couple like really great legacy articles so far. I'm looking forward to whatever the next one is for Channel Fireball. Wrote about Force of Negation and whether it's a good or a bad thing for legacy. McBandish, you maybe want to give us the gist of what Lawrence talked about. Hopefully he's not going to listen to this and be like, you've misrepresented me, McBain, bastard.
Well, it was what I found interesting. It was like the premise or the question of the article was about, is force negation or more force of wills or force negations bad for the format? But the entire bulk of the article leading up to the kind of like final summary or conclusion was all about cantrips and like how legacy decks have changed over time or presumably changed over time, playing basically going from more of a critical mass of interactive spells. So like your top of your deck was more powerful to less interactive spells and more kind of air or cantrips to find what you need at the right time. And I really found like that the interesting insight or discussion in the article, but there was this whole other component of, therefore this all being said, is force negation bad for the format? When I kind of like looked at both the articles, and we can maybe kind of put that force negation comment to the end because they actually kind of like dovetail together. But that was like the main thing that I took away from the article. I'm not sure if there was something else that you had seen in there, Quinn.
I think that's the force negation framing is the thing I really loved about Lawrence's article. Because one, I think we've heard that question. I think I've asked that probably on this podcast. I know I've certainly asked that to you guys, but like, is this healthy? And I think starting from there as like, kind of examining that outcome, like how is it okay suddenly to pay six force of wills when before you were boarding them out in control matchups or boarding them out in fair blue mirrors? You know, how has that become a thing, and is this okay for the format, and like what got us here? And then I liked a lot how like Lawrence worked from like, this is how you see the problem, and like I'm going to tell you like how this happened. And I think like going through like how cantrips worked, how decks, blue decks kind of changed over time, was like a really good way of like illustrating. Should I give away the thesis, or are we going to kind of tease this out still? I think kind of illustrating that like, you know, the power level of cards means that like, one, your cantrips are less powerful, holding onto them is worse, and cards that are kind of like, you know, quote unquote, like strict card disadvantage become worth it. You know, like I think even think about like how I still kind of like default think of Force of Will. It's like, oh, Force of Will saves me from Reanimator, or Force of Will saves me from, you know, the combo deck that I'm racing with my combo deck if I'm playing like Infect. But if I'm playing, you know, a Delver deck, well, I don't want those. I don't want to get two for one myself trying to Force of Will, you know, like a Delver or something. Like I have days for that. I'm going to like tempo them out. And I think that is like the real crux of it. And like Lawrence kind of comes to that conclusion where he's like, Force of Negation is like an outcome, but it's just like a symptom of a problem that's like much larger, and it's certainly not the cause. And I would agree with that like 100%.
Jeff?
I'm fully acknowledging I'm the outsider in this conversation. But I mean, yeah, that's really it. Like for the force of negation thing, in addition to just the general consistency of it, is that the kind of purpose of those cards have changed. I mean, like Quinn said, you know, it used to be something you board out in a bunch of like fair matchups, just kind of a general heuristic. But like now that it's like a offensive force of will, more or less, I don't know, it's a different world. And everything to do with cantrips, as you know, I'm still sitting here listening to cantrip story time by everybody that can tell me anything.
So just as you kind of mentioned that force of will battle, one thing from over the holidays playing Rogue Delver online that I learned is like a little edge, at least from my own perspective, that I was like, oh yeah, this is way better, was if you had like a red blast that you're going to kill an Oko or something like that, is you do it on their turn in their upkeep, because odds are they're going to have, like, especially, well, maybe if it's a lightning bolt or something like that, but like it turns off their force negation at that point. Like they might have two lands and you're like red blast. Whereas if you did it on your turn, they're just able to force negation and you kind of negate the force negation potential. They obviously still have other counters, but a lot of these decks have trimmed down. This was especially prevalent in like Rug Mirrors. But a lot of these decks have trimmed down so that they're like either just days and forces and that's it. There's no spell pierces or spell snares. So I definitely like main phased a number of removal spells that just got negationed. And I was like, why did I do that? I could just wait and then it would resolve just fine.
But I guarantee you there'll be some time over this god account period where I'm sitting with the force negation in my hand and I click on it and I have like a split second where I go, why is there only one mode? That'll be that exact scenario where someone good has blown up like Uro or something.
You're like, why is this not clickable? What's going on?
Yeah, I want to force this. What's going on? This thing is supposed to be good. I have six of these things in my deck.
I'm filing for compensation.
So one thing that I kind of wanted to mention off the hop was, as I was kind of churning through this cantrip discussion, I kind of was thinking back to some of like the, and I they're kind of called like, well, Stephen Menendian anyway calls them like the schools of magic, or like the main archetypal ideas of magic. Like the one we all know and love is card advantage, and that was something that really Brian Weissman is kind of famous for kind of coming up with and making what's called the deck in original vintage. But it's all about like accruing more cards than your opponent, either by having one thing
Brian Weissman knows about, it's secret card advantage.
Exactly. And it's so things like in the old days, it was like Disrupting Scepter, where you can just have a thing that just makes your opponent discard a card and you're going to eventually end up with more resources than them, or having something like a JMD Tome or Library that draws more cards. In modern legacy terms, it would be like, I have a Jace that's giving me Brainstorm, which nets me a card each time. And over time, I'm going to build up more and more cards. And then I can just exchange one for one with you, and eventually you'll run out of cards and I can just do stuff. And a lot of control players just love card advantage. Like anytime they have to go down on cards, it's just like, I don't want to do that. It's the worst thing ever, because eventually I'm going to lose the game because I won't have an answer when I need it. And that's why we kind of have that heuristic of like, board out your forces and control mirrors and things like that, or things where you're going to go a long grindy game and you don't want a 2-for-1 yourself. Like why discard or exile a ponder, for example, with your force of will, when you could be like pondering for your lightning bolts and swords to plowshares or whatever. So that was like one of the main ideas, and Lawrence's kind of take on this, and Rich talks about it a little bit too, is because of the increased power, to your point, Quinn, is things are getting so powerful that you can't really afford to like eke out all the little value and get those, what was it, Adrian Sullivan and who's the other Star City guy who coined the perfect, quote unquote, perfect brainstorm back in the SCG days?
This is new to me. What is
Chapin? The perfect brainstorm? I'm just guessing. I don't know.
I want to say it was Adrian Sullivan and I am blanking on his name.
Cedric.
I think it was Cedric, yeah. But just that fact of like waiting, getting like two extra lands in your hand, casting Brainstorm, putting two lands back, and then like fetching them away or something like that, and you basically drew three new cards. Like you don't have time to do that anymore because, or you'll have less opportunities to do that because cards are so powerful these days.
Yeah, it seems like one of the basic takes on cantrips from, I mean, particularly Rich's article, I think it even like says this, is like, you don't want to lose the game with a Brainstorm in your hand. So like you need to be more aggressive, which is, it's interesting coming, you know, to me, and I'm dumping all this information in my brain. You know, I did my homework and I watched Brian Koval's videos on general, you know, eternal cantrips and some shortcuts and ideas he had for Brainstorm. And then now that's kind of the fundamentals, but a lot of the stuff just doesn't really apply in the current arms race we're in. So maybe I'm worse now. Thanks, McBain.
Yeah, pre 2020 and like maybe like
pre
War of the Spark, the mantra was pre-War of the Spark, the mantra was like, if in doubt, like hold on to your Brainstorm because it's going to get better as the game goes on. When one, you have more dead cards, and two, you know exactly what you need to do. Whereas now both Rich and Lawrence were talking about this, whereas now you kind of need to be more proactive. So like if in doubt, like fire the Brainstorm off and like try to move forward.
It's weird because it's like so like antithetical to like the way I think almost every Legacy player I know plays the format. Like, you know, everything is about those like 3 to 4 step plans to like, you know, just slowly accrue that card advantage and just climb over the hill.
So I have a different take than this. And maybe a smarter Infect player than me would be like, well, you were just wrong. But I have always, going way back to like what, episode 2 or 3, you know, when I was like delving for poison. Idiots, I think the trickiest part of Infect is more than anything the question you're asking. And I mean, you have to ask with a lot of decks, but like, is who's the beatdown? But that is like so central to Infect. And so like you still don't EOTU Brainstorm a lot, but there are just times where you like, you're playing in certain matchups, like in, especially in like the Grixis Delver era, where you're like, my opponent, you know, maybe they made a mistake, tapped out for a K command, and I vinced and just saved my dude, got in for like, you know, chipped in for 2 points, you know, or, you know, they did something and I, you know, they're passing back and like EOT Brainstorm's like actually okay, because it's like the window of card advantage closes because it's not a real Delver deck and it has Invigorate that's only good if you have a creature, and Invigorate that's, you know, bad if you don't have a creature, and probably worse if you have a creature and, you know, you're just going to get blown out when you try and put the Invigorate on the stack. There's a lot of like cards that become fluff. Mm-hmm. And so like there is like a similar kind of thought where like, actually I was on camera one time at in Seattle, and they were like, I don't know why Quinn's brainstorming here. I think like he should be like waiting until he has more cards in hand. And I was playing against Grixis Delver. I was playing against Josh Monks, and he was, I think that was the game where he he went him, snap him in his like 2 turns against me. And I was like, well, that's bad. And I managed to get like 3 cards in my hand, and one of them was a Brainstorm, and I brainstormed. And they're like, well, I would have waited. And I think Josh also had 3 cards in his hand, and I'm like, no, this is like my window. Like, to like claw some extra cards back, because I can't win with less cards in my hand, and he has a board presence and he's putting like some pressure, a little bit of pressure on me, like it's too late. And I think like that was a thing that was kind of unique to Infect, and now it feels more like that's how Legacy plays out. Mm-hmm. As soon as someone like finds an Oko, like you are like, you don't want them to do that. So even before that, if you're anticipating the Oko, you're closing in on turn 3, you're desperately trying to find an answer if you don't have one once you realize what's going on. And that's like a big change.
It's definitely more like that situation is more likely to come up now, where there's some kind of, you're put in a position or a threat, like you've been asked a question in some way that people phrase it, but you need to move forward your game state. And if you're not being proactive, even though you're not going to lose right then and there, as soon as they're up on like two cards or something on you, the game is just going to spiral out of control and you're going to be angry about something down the road. But it's like, no. What really killed you was not trying to get lucky in that situation early on and realizing that that was the turning point. And sometimes people like refer to that as like the critical turn or like when you need to actually have game actions. And that's, it was highlighted in Rich's article about being proactive with your game plan and really just making sure that you have something to move forward. Like in Jeff's case, it's like, I want to get this white grizzly bear down to potentially disrupt my opponent, hopefully doing something. But like moving your board forward and not just like sitting on some cantrips, because the issue with cantrips, and maybe we can kind of go back to those, but the thing with cantrips is you are paying mana to get options but not affect the board at all, which is a bit of a problem when everyone's trying to be proactive and push the game forward, which is actually like a bit of a criticism that I have with Lawrence's article, where they're talking about decks wanting to have less interactive spells and more cantrips. And it can be a problem if people are jamming their Dreadhorde that you need to answer. So then you're casting your cantrips hoping to find your answer. Or it's like, well, what if you potentially had more answers or you had something to go over top of their thing? And really, this is where his conclusion looped back around to ultimately, is force negation or more force is bad for the format, because you can stop that one threat that's potentially happening and you have a higher likelihood of finding the threat to stop it, which is why people are playing more cantrips. Here we go. But one of the things when I was reading these, I wanted to like kind of go back. So we kind of talked about the card advantage component, and Quinn, you touched on why you have to be able to recognize when card advantage is not going to be the reason why you're winning this game. And you need to like Rugdelver's always been very good at that, where it's like, I don't care about cards. I'm going to 2-for-1 myself all I want. If I win the game with 0 cards in my hand, my opponent has 7. I was up +7 on cards because like they never got to do anything. But I want to go back, and really this is for you, Jeff, about like cantrips and like what the real idea behind them is. And this goes back to, he's crossing his fingers and leaning in.
I'm intently studying.
This goes back to the idea of giving yourselves options and playing a thinner mana base and being able to put more stuff in your deck. So it goes back to like 1997 with a guy named Alan Comer. And this was I can't remember exactly what it was. It was like some qualifier or something, like a PTT qualifier. But the guy like gets second place in this type 2 event with no rares in his deck, just like shows up and crushes everyone. And he's playing 17 Island and a whole bunch of cantrips and like blue dirtily things and some Force of Wills and counter spells and stuff like that. And it's all about being able to keep these one land or two land hands, use your cantrips to find more lands. And then later on down the road, you can, once you've got the 3 or 4 lands that you have later on down the road, you can cast cantrips to find the threats or the answers that you need. And you're not going to be drawing into more lands.
These cantrips are bad.
Oh yeah, they're bad. They're real bad. But
4 portent, 4 shadow. Oh. A combo, I guess.
So, but the whole idea, or like the kind of like heuristic, is that for every 2 cantrips you add, you can shave a land from your deck. Because again, all you need is that like 1 or 2 land hand to keep, and then you ponder on your turn. Ponder gives you potentially 4 cards to see if you need to hit another land. And the likelihood of like a land being in those 4 cards is pretty high. So like, then you can get to 2 lands on your turn, and then you cantrip again, or maybe you've just drawn another land, and then you've established the mana that you need. And then every draw step is going to be like things that you need and not things that you don't. So that's the idea with cantrips. And for me, like Lawrence had made this point about like, really he kind of, to be fair, he did focus more on like control decks. And he didn't just say like all legacy decks except for Rugdelver. Praise be to Rugdelver. Except for Rugdelver were built wrong because they didn't have like maximum cantrips in them. And he was citing like the 2012, 2013 era. And I was kind of like, really? Like I thought like Rugdelver was a thing like before that and other decks were like that before that. And I went back and I looked and like the first Legacy GP in 2005 had like Canadian Threshold in it with decks loaded to the nines with cantrips. Like the first deck here or one of the decks that I had linked has like four Brainstorm, four Serum Visions, three Predict, and four Accumulated Knowledge. It's like, that's like 2020 level or like peak level cantrip in terms of like, I'm not doing anything other than drawing cards.
Right. I'm playing a goose and I'm drawing cards.
Yeah. Or you're playing a werebear and drawing cards in this case. and like, obviously some like the cantrips have evolved, like Ponder wasn't around at that point, but like there was decks in Legacy, particularly these more like quote unquote tempo decks that played a lot of cantrips. And to Lawrence's point, like the control decks often played Brainstorm and that's it. And they like maybe played like one or two other things. And again, I went and looked back and I was like, really, is that the case? And I opened up the Madrid 2010 GP. And that was not the case. Like some of these decks, like there's a Progenitus like no bant deck, and it's down to like 18 lands. It's got Noble Hierarch, it's got Brainstorms, Ponders, and then it's got three Sensei's Divining Tops in it. Like it's doing the whole cantrip filter thing. So like to me, this kind of like point and some of the decks he showed about showing this critical mass of interactive spells shifting to less interactive spells, I wasn't really buying it at the end of the day. Like to an extent.
I think that shift was between like this 2010 period though and like 2019. Because even when I started playing Legacy, like not that Infect plays like four Ponders now, usually, but like there were just some lists that are like zero Ponders and you had Gitaxian Probe, but like it's like at some point someone was like Gitaxian Probe's a crutch, Ponder's better. And I remember like reading that on the source and being like, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, like Probe's just free. And I have become immense and like Probe's so good. Like why would I ever cut Probes for Ponders or add extra Ponders?
Where it comes back. The
control decks, like between 2010, like, you know, this, whenever this period was, I think I started playing Legacy in like 2013 and 2019, like you saw kind of like blue decks play four Ponders in by default, you know, like more do than don't. And I think like he was correct in that way, where now they still do it. They play them differently though.
So to your point on Infect, I think is the Ponder is correct, is better in the way that it let, again, going back to that mana component and making sure you have optionality in the early game and then in the late game, is better than just like being able to kind of look over the table and say like, do you have it and kill you? Like it's more like, I am going to be progressing my game plan and always be moving forward. Because I think to your point about when to go for it and when to not go for it is, and why it was so evident with Infect, is because you have such a potent late game that it's not like you're going to get out-resourced. It's like you can create a situation kind of like Depths where it's like, I'm going to kill you and there's nothing you're going to be able to do about it. I don't need a Gitaxian Probe to like solve that problem. It's just like, I'm going to set up a situation to kill you, or I can go really fast and kill you. And that's there's nothing to say about it.
Like you still played some number of Probes for a gut band. But Ponder crept up because I think enough people, and I remember like talking about some of the source, as Grixis Delver and then Grixis Control rose, and then like Check Pile as well, you had enough instances where someone was like, I probed them and I realized I couldn't win. And then all I did was draw a land off my probe and I was dead. And like, if that card's ponder, you know, you probably still are in your head, like, I can't go for it, but it's helping you sculpt a hand where you can.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I need, in this situation, I need a counter to protect my creature. Not like, can I look over the table and again, see if you have a thing to kill my creature?
Cause I've taken a peek and I know I'm dead. Great. And then I got to draw one card that I couldn't look at beforehand.
Unless you're like
Time Eevee.
Unless you're like wearing like the leather jacket and you're a Stone Cold Master and you look at their hand and you're like, oh, perfect. That's exactly what I expected. Attack in and just total bluff and then somehow win. I don't know.
Don't get me wrong. That does happen. There were just like, yeah, there were also, I mean, that's why Contacting Probe should be banned. There were still like, you know, other times where, but you were just getting lucky and like going back to look at that. I think you were like, it wasn't like Probe got you out of situations. Like Probe just told you when you're going to get lucky. Whereas Ponder allowed you to like craft a game state and outplay someone.
Yeah. It led to better play patterns. Ultimately so I want to go to this 2012, 2013 period for a second, but I came across this amazing deck in my journeys. And this is like right before I started playing Legacy. And I wanted to just take a side detour on it. And this is as I was trying to like look at Lawrence's conversation about the whole like control decks going from 22 to 23 lands down to like 19 or 20. And again, shaving lands, the heuristic being for every two cantrips you add, you can shave a land. So theoretically, decks are adding 4 to 6 cantrips in this case. But 2009, this was for Grand Prix Chicago. And two of the top decks were this deck called Next Level Blue. And it was won by Gabriel Nassif. This deck looked wild, though. When I saw this, I was like, this was some amazing Legacy.
This is Jeff, so nasty.
When we were setting up, like, I saw you click on it, and I was like, oh, yeah, Jeff, what do you think?
Drink deep.
Yeah, so this was maybe, Jeff, do you want to kind of describe the adventure that you went on when you looked at this thing?
Sure. I clicked on this, and the first thing my eye locked on is Vidalcan Shackles, which is such a good time. And then the second thing my eyes bounced to is Trigon Predator, which these are like the two staples of everybody's cubes 5 years ago.
Yeah, when I had a cube, I definitely had both of those in there.
The deck's sweet. It's an abomination of a 4-color mana base. It's everything but red. Dark Confidants, Sower of Temptation, Goyf, Trigon Predator, Brainstorm, Daze, Force.
Did you take a look at Andy Probasco, the brass man himself, his list?
Oh, I got to click on this one. Three Trinket Mage. Two
Academy Roots, three Trinket Mage, a main deck Pithing Needle that he finds off that Trinket Mage.
I got to stop
it. Like, you have top. And so like Trinket Mage just finds you top also, which like, you know, is great.
Yeah. This
and then having Academy Ruins to put, having Academy Ruins to put things on top of your deck to then counterbalance someone off of is pretty spicy.
Rebuying Engineered Explosives.
I love looking at these old lists for stuff that like was around when like I started playing Legacy, like Planar Void.
But honestly, like, if you're listening, go look at this top 8. Like, the decks in here are, like, pretty spicy.
GP Chicago, 2009. 1,200 people.
I have to say, it's probably not a healthy meta if there's two main deck Gross End Grips. But...
yeah, you could definitely see there's this, like, counterbalance shackles arms race going on. Especially when, like, Nassif has, like, Trigon Predator's main, Sower of Temptation's main... Like imagine playing your Trigon Predator and your opponent's like, okay, I'm going to take it. And then start killing you with other things.
My favorite thing in this top 8 is there's a Dragon Stompy.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say that.
But like, I mean, so it plays the whole host of good cards like Arc Slogger and Gathan Raiders and Rakdos Pit Dragon. But the most shocking thing to me is that it plays 2 Blood Moons and 1 other Blood Moon in the sideboard.
And then 4 Trinisphere, 4 Chromox, 4 Chalice.
But like 2 Blood Moon?
I know, right? But I don't know. Maybe it was, I don't know. It was This is a wild top eight. There's a zoo deck. And then, of course, no top eight is complete without a Rug Delver deck sneaking in there.
One wipe
away. We gotta mention Eva Green too, right? For James.
Yeah.
Piloted shout out by, to James. By none other than Paul Reitzel. You know, like this whole top eight, there's like a lot of like incredible
with players, that but. Stellar sideboard dodecapod. Anyway, this I went on like a huge divergent when I was going through this, and I was kind of like pulling some notes together. And I was like, man, this 2009, 2010 legacy looked wild. That could be a whole other discussion in and of itself.
I was going to say, are any of these like other formats you're playing, like are any of these decks existing in them?
Well, on the cantrip discussion, so maybe we'll just do a little short tangent, but I've been playing some pre-modern, and that format, like we did talk about it a couple, maybe a dozen episodes ago or something like that, but things like Force of Will and Brainstorm and Ponder, well, Ponder's obviously not in it, but Force of Will and Brainstorm are banned in the format. So it's not like Legacy Light or anything like that. It's like very much new or old, like extended or standard decks that have like been readjusted. So it's unique in that regard, but the deck that I'm playing is a Groatog deck, which is basically a deck loaded with cantrips. So I've got like Opt, I've got Peak, which is, you know, a card. Shout out to James Sue.
Are you playing Fortel?
I'm not. I am playing for Portent, and
you're missing out on the combo.
And I'm playing some Sleight of Hands as well. But recently, in the game that I played earlier today, just a final thing, I was playing against a Stifle Knot opponent, and I got a threat down, and then I kept portenting them on top of their deck to like keep them off their combo as I continued to beat down. And I was like, this is the most aggressive portent I've ever seen. Like,
I remember playing against Dylan when he's on Miracles, and like portent was like a thing. And like just the shift in tone when he goes portent, and you're like, uh-huh, he's like, target you, and you're like, oh
yeah, I'm dead. I did have a game where my opponent, like a couple days ago, where my opponent mulliganed to six, and then I had like a pretty aggressive start. And they like went Wasteland Go. And then on my second turn, I was like, portent, target you. And the guy's like, I'm going to concede, and like scooped. So like to hide information so that I couldn't like board against him because he didn't think he was going to win game one. I was like, wow, lethal portent. I like it. So that's a side piece. Cantrips.
Like when it came out, I remember it being like, I just was like so infatuated with that card because it was still at a time where, I mean, maybe at that point there were people playing with real decks, but like I played Magic with just kids in the neighborhood. And so casting a portent was like a true reveal to be like, show me what you've opened in packs, and like looking at cards sometimes and being like, I don't even know what this is. And just be like, shuffle it away.
That one's big and has lots of mana cost. Put that on the bottom. Like, I'm scared of that.
That's the kind of card too, that like as a kid, that too. you don't even consider targeting yourself. Ever.
No, I was just like, I need to see what you're doing. I didn't understand virtual card advantage. So, you know, McBain, when you're like big mana cost, not like we'll just kill them before they play the thing for nine mana.
Yeah, you're like, oh my god, an Elder Dragon?
It's a 10-10. Yeah, Leviathan? Oh my god, what's the drawback? I don't even care. I can't beat that.
So, back on track. I did go and I looked at this like 2012, 2013 time frame, and I was looking again for this like shift in mana bases where they were going down on lands. There was a lot of decks that were like mid-rangey, control-y, that were already at this 20 land kind of threshold. The ones that were above were two different decks. And honestly, I think it kind of comes back to the style of the deck being built and Lawrence's point about the decks being bad decks or being poorly designed. But really it was Shardless Bug. So things that had Shardless Agent in them, and then they were playing Ancestral Visions because of cascading into Ancestral Visions, which is kind of taking that Ponder slot. And then the other one was these Blade decks, these Stoneforge decks, which everyone who's played with Stoneforge knows that you get into these situations where you're like, okay, turn two Stoneforge, turn three don't do anything because I want to like keep my mana up and like deploy the thing I got.
No tricks and here.
Then, yeah, you're just like, go ahead again. I'm not going to do anything. And if you're in those kind of play patterns, playing a ponder or something in amongst all of that isn't that great. Or you don't want to play ponder in these cascade decks because you don't want to hit it. You'd rather hit a Tarmogoyf for Ancestral Visions, for example. So it felt like maybe the decks were bad because they weren't just playing a whole boatload of cantrips. But I think it was more to the effect of like, I'm not playing these ponder cantrips because the upside of these other cards is greater based on the metagame. And I don't know if like Shardless, just not playing Shardless Agent, not playing Ancestral Visions, and just going more down the road to that like check pile deck would have been better at the time. It's a bit counterfactual, but it felt to me like when I looked at it, I was like, man, Shardless Bug was sweet. Like some of the things that you're hitting, as long as you're not hitting that Abrupt Decay into nothing, it was a pretty sweet deck.
That was a sweet deck. That was like also the ultimate like value pile when I was starting.
Yeah. I definitely remember fondly the games against Trenton from Victoria when the Victoria group would come over. And I'd always get paired up against him and he would just like outvalue, outcard advantage, outgrind you. But so to me it was like, yes, it didn't have ponder, but it had like cantrip like effects. But again, it's not reducing that land count because you're not getting the filtering of the cantrips.
I think like that bug at that time, like Shardless Bug is just like just competing philosophies. You know, where like cantrips is like one type of value, and this was like, I'm gonna hit Ancestral Vision at some point, and that's such like a huge tempo swing, mm-hmm. or huge card advantage swing, I guess, more correctly. That it's just worth it. And it like, I think that's an interesting, I'm not saying it's better or worse, but it's an interesting period of legacy because I don't think that could exist now because there's so much value that putting yourself at the hands of kind of randomness to be like, more often than not, the game's going to go long enough that I can like extend it till I hit this Ancestral Vision and then suddenly I'm up on so many cards that like you can't come back. Like that would not happen now because you're playing like Uro.
And if you go back to Shardless, it was like Shardless Bug had an awful combo matchup because it was really trying to get to this like turn four, turn five, when it would go, haha, I have all these cards now, and now you're going to die. Whereas now it's just like, Veil, kill you, and that's it. Going back to the beginning with that comment from Stephen Menindian, the like kind of Weissman school of magic about just card advantage. When Alan Comer in 97 came out with this Xerox style of just play a whole bunch of cantrips, reduce your land count, and have more consistency and more things in your deck to go find and do, that was kind of like another school of magic that was created. Like there's other ones. There's like what's called like the O'Brien school of magic after Sean O'Brien, which is all about just like blowing up lands and like ruining your opponent's resources to the point where they can't do anything. Which I have also an affinity for.
That's a good school of magic. I think we can all agree to that.
Yeah. And it's like mono black, sinkhole, strip mine, just like evilness is that school of magic. So there's a number of schools of magic. And really, like to your point, Quinn, about like there's competing philosophies. Really, that's kind of what you're saying is there's like the card advantage, I'm going to win in the long game. And then there's the I want maximum flexibility and consistency to a degree. And I think what's won out, and to Lawrence's point, is what's winning out is these having more consistency is where Legacy is going more and more.
But like Magic is going, right? Like they don't like, well, they like printing land destruction spells. We're never getting another Sinkhole.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a number of... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think it's funny, and it's that kind of expectation thing. I always think a really, for me, like a seminal conversation in my like understanding of magic was one with Dylan, friend of the show. He's Doomsday, but I always know him as the Miracles guy, who I've talked about here before.
I just mentioned him about 10 minutes ago.
To simplify, Quinn, he's really blue cantrips and counterspells with something else, be it counterbalance and mentor or Doomsday.
Yeah. And I think I'm wrong to characterize him as a control player, but I like knew him, you know, I met him as like the Miracles guy in our local meta.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember him being like, well, the thing about Miracles is you thought you died when you died and you actually died. And you kind of mentioned this earlier in a different perspective. Like, you know, you actually died 10 turns ago.
Mm-hmm.
Where was I going with this? Fuck.
I'll give a side. This is really just a dagger for Dylan, but I've always viewed him as a very conservative player. And if you're trying, like, you know, those games where you're like, I need to like move ahead, but like, I might like open myself up to X, Y, or Z. And therefore I'm kind of in a rock and a hard place. It's just like, pretend that you have the thing that he's scared about and just move ahead. And like, he's conservative enough that he won't kind of call you on it. He'll always be like, I'm going to wait down the road because I'm ultimately going to get you. And I'm like, that's fine. I just got away with this. Like, I was going to die or fall way further behind, but you can move ahead. So that's always something to kind of look for, than how your opponents are playing. But I think when I was kind of going through this chronology, the thing that like stood out to me as like peak minimum interactive spells, maximum air, I'm not going to do anything, like, was the 2014-2015 Miracles period, when I kind of linked in our show notes here, the Philip Schoeniger, he had a primer. He was like a famous Miracles player at the time. Now he's off doing some can't say it apparently. Academic. I think he's doing his PhD now in psychology or something.
Academia?
Academia, thank you. I can speak clean. Good. But in this case, he's got like sense in his Miracles deck. He's got four Sensei's Top, four Brainstorm, four Ponder, and then he's got a whole bunch of Snapcaster Mages on top of this, and then Jace the Mind Sculptor. So you can just set up these situations where you're just continually filtering, getting exactly what you need just at the right time, and then ultimately getting Jace the Mind Sculptor and then moving into that card advantage realm where you're now accruing advantage that way. But to me, I just remember that deck, and like, Dylan's probably just like shedding a tear because he doesn't get to play this anymore. But like, this was just peak do nothing Miracles that was slowly killing you over 15 turns. And I fondly remember it when I have like Nimble Mongoose in play, but like most other times it was pretty brutal to play against. And it was really hard to like, you know, here's my Blood Moon. And they're just like, no, I'm just going to like look for answers. There's my answer. Okay. Move on with life. What was it like, Jeff, for you like playing against this with D&T?
Miracles like countertop and everything.
Yeah. All of the, like when it went away from like Lissette and it was just like a million gantrips and stuff.
Oh, it was tons of fun. I used to love playing against Dylan or going out to Seattle and playing against the guys. I mean, the game was completely different if you had like a turn one vial or not. And I remember playing like, you know, two caverns in the deck that had way less matching creature types than it does now. You know, you got a cavern on Angel and you're trying to get your Sarah Avenger in. I don't know. It was a good time. There's a lot of, you know, it's the same as it honestly always is. There's picking spots and there's, you know, finding your battles and trying to, you know, weave your way through this web of cantrips.
This is going to sound like the most boomer comment of all time, but it really felt like you had to work for it. You know, every deck had to work for it. I don't know. That's how I felt. That's like what I love most about Legacy is like, I played degenerate combo decks, so sometimes I'm like, sorry, killed you. But the games I remember are the ones where I was like, wow. Like, you know, similar to like when you're like versus Miracles, like it's really about like Aether Vial when I was like, oh yeah, I just like, they let the Ponder go and then I found an Ink Moth Nexus And I think they were waiting to counter Blighted Agent, and the Inkpoth Nexus just went all the way. And those are the games where you're like, man, I like feel good. I'm a good Magic player. You know, like, I mean, I've been happy, obviously, when I'm like turn to Invigorate Berserk, kill you. But if that was all that Magic was, you know, like flip a coin and like who gets it, I wouldn't be as invested. And yeah. I think like that top Miracles era, there was a lot of like, I just got there, but I got there. And this, now, like, you know, I feel like a genius.
Those matchups for like D&T and Miracles at that time too came down so much to like the amount of games you win just on like Violent 2, Athalia, and a Caracas, and like nothing else matters. You're just like, I'm protecting this thing at all costs. I'm chipping in piece by piece. I'm bouncing it back to my hand. I'm putting it into play when it's safe. And, you know, just riding that one piece as they're desperately trying to, you know, honestly, in a lot of ways, Thalia was really good then because they have so much air with their cantrips trying to dig. Like the amount of time it buys where they have to find their specific pieces and everything, you know, kind of exponentially grows and they have to like ponder into ponder.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Those are good times.
So
having to chain cantrips to find an answer to Thalia feels horrible.
Oh, it feels so good.
Yeah. So two thoughts here. Lawrence made this comment about like having 2012, 2013 Rug Delvers and just playing the mirrors all day. Well, that sounds great and all. I think the three of us could probably agree that like if you had three decks and it was Rug Delver versus Miracles versus D&T, and you just like randomly each of you picked two of those up or picked one of those up and just like played against it and then put them back, randomized them around and picked the other two up and just like continually battled those three. I think that's like, you could spend an afternoon doing that. And
such a great like microcosm of everything that would be great about that time period.
Yeah.
I need to add another deck. I think Sneak and Show should be in there.
Actually, I would co-sign that. Because then you get that combo aspect and like
there's gotta be you gotta get punished sometimes if you're going too slow.
Well, I would be curious what the D&T show and tell matchup was around that time.
Oh, back when it was actually good.
Yeah, if it's just like 60% for show and tell, maybe not, or like pick a little bit of a different time. But like to me, like so many of those games were just like so skill intensive.
Or maybe like Ant, you know, like there's gotta be one yeah. combo deck. I think
are you dancing around the way to say, how about Infect?
No, I don't think it should be Infect.
No, I think in so many ways, like Infect's kind of like a Delvery deck.
Yeah.
To an extent.
It's a Delvery combo deck. It doesn't really fit, which is probably why as a contrarian, I like it, but I do think like if you're thinking of like gold, if that's our golden age of Legacy, which I'm sure some people who are older than us or have been in the game long enough will disagree with. But if, like for me, I'm like, yeah, there's like a combo deck, there's D&T, there's a Delver deck, and there's Miracles, and that's like that was like the sweet spot. Mm-hmm.
It'd be fun to kind of just have them like all four face down. It's just like, all right, each of you put $10 down and just like randomize, pick one. And
oh, like, God, who it's wins? Just me being like, please, not D&T, fuck. I don't know what to do.
One day we'll have a Campfish D&T school for YouTube.
Yeah, there you go. If it's ever playable again, you know. So the other question was, looking at this Schoeniger list, he's got two counterspells in the deck. I could easily see those in modern day, or if Force Negation was legal at that time, just being Force Negation and being six forces in the deck. I think like back then, like again, counterbalance was that threat. Like you have to counter this and stop it. Just in I the think same that's, way.
But that, with counterbalance, I don't think you need Force Negation.
I think it's more the fact that you don't want your opponent's counterbalance to resolve, or your opponent's what would now be like modern day Oko or Dreadhorde or whatever. But it's like, I don't want that to resolve.
Counterspell makes play draw a lot more impactful. That makes sense too.
Yeah.
I think you just end up cutting the, like, I think the thing that changes here that's most impactful is you like cut the Jaces for Okos, right? Like if you're
probably not wrong.
Trade, if you could trade one card for another card, like I think that's probably it. Like, can you imagine getting beat down by Tops?
Can you imagine getting beat down by Oko with a counterbalance like top lock in play?
Yeah, and the top just flips and the top becomes a 3-3 again? Well, I guess you can't do both, but you know, some of the tops flip, some of the tops are 3-3s.
I just mean having an Oko that's like even harder to like deal with.
Yeah, they get their second top into play, and then the first top becomes a 3-3 and starts like beat bashing face on you. That's nasty.
So Lawrence had this other point in the article about this increase in Xerox strategies or excessive cantrips and that decreasing down to 19 or 20 lands. He said it was really changed when Oko came out and kind of like pushed things like Chalice of the Void, which could so punish these cantrip decks, or like Thalia in your perspective, Jeff, where you just play this one like two drop thing and it totally hoses their game plan. Like everything costs twice as much as it normally should, or they can't play anything at all.
Yeah, Chalice especially when you're talking about these decks that are, you know, just kind of adopting all the air.
And now Oko can just come down and turn off whatever is stopping them and just continue on their merry way, which is just brutal. But this point of like Chalice being a potent counter to these one drop decks and everything, last week, PVDH was kind of like looking at like MTG top eight results and like the metagame over the last decade. And he had this like kind of weird squiggly Excel bar graph or line graph of like how commonly cards were played. And I remember looking at it and being like, oh, that's interesting. And like back in that kind of Philip Schoeniger era, like Brainstorm is up to like almost 75% of the format is playing Brainstorm in the deck, which is just insane. And now it's down to like almost 50%, but there's this kind of like line for Chalice of the Void, and it's never really been more than 15% of the format. And that would be like in like Eldrazi and Four Color Loam being the two main ones. And then obviously like Blood Moon and some decks like that, but it didn't necessarily give that like, oh, like, you know, cantrips are popping up, so now everyone's playing Chalice or things like that. It was kind of like a little bit of an overstated point, but again, I think even I would argue that Oko stopping Chalice is something that would dramatically change the metagame if Oko was removed right now. I think you'd get a lot more of less like Eldrazi or Urza or the Moon. Blood Moon deck.
Yeah,
the Moon deck. I think those would come back with vengeance. They're very strong decks. You drop Oko out of the metagame, and then all of a sudden these air decks that are just cantripping all along that can't just simply answer a Chalice. Like, I think things would change a lot. That's just a kind of side ban discussion, but...
I mean, obviously that's great because I've been talking about Oko in particular, but I mean, I think I've been kind of like vacillating back and forth between like maybe it's not Oko, and like smarter people than me have been like, no, Uro's the problem, or McBain, you've been talking about like Dreadhorde a lot. But I think I've come back around to like Oko's the problem. Like, you shouldn't have main deck outs to Chalice unless you're looking, you know, you're like, well, if you're playing a Krosan grip, sure, get it. You know, if you want to play that in your main deck, great, you got my Chalice. But like, and again, huge bias from like when I started playing Legacy, but I always think of like the pillars of Legacy as like Force of Will, Chalice of the Void, Blood Moon, Wasteland. You know, like the blue decks get a thing where they're like, I'm not just going to die. Otherwise, you know, Chalice would be the greatest card of all time, or Blood Moon would be the greatest card of all time in game one. You know, I have an out, and then those other three cards are just like, if you get too greedy, we're gonna get you.
And pretty sure the pillars are Forcible, Brainstorm, Ponder, but like,
oh, Brainstorm just there.
Yeah,
I think sort of like, I guess the policeman of the format.
Yeah, I always like the kind of like triangle of, well, Aether Vial for one. Anytime like Aether Vial is like a good playable strategy, Chalice being a good playable strategy, and then again like these cantrip decks, which covers like a huge segment of the format. Like, cantrip decks are half the format, but you need to have things that can go toe to toe with that very efficient strategy that has been in modern, like they've banned all the good ones. In vintage, they've restricted all the good ones. Legacy is the only place where like all the cantrips just run free. Yeah. So I think it's really important to have cantrips under control and like viable strategies that can like fight against them. As well,
and
as
I think that's why, as a negative thinker, I think about like Who are the cops? You know, like whether they're necessary or not, up for debate, but like they kind of have to be there, you know? Do you want to defund them? That's up to you, Jeff. But like there's four things that are just like, they're not like proactive things. So I think you're right. Like brainstorms the true pillar of legacy, you know, like, sorry, Colin, it should never go away. But the things that keep those decks in check are like the three like kind of nasty things, right? Like force of will, which, you know, again, when I joined Legacy was like, you play it because you have to, not because you want to. And that's changed. And then, yeah, the three kind of like the hoser cards, you know, like Blood Moon got you were too greedy. Chalice got you were too greedy. Wasteland got you were too greedy. Like, I think that's the thing. Like Legacy, because all these, like all the filtering spells exist because the dual lands exist. Like it's like the greed format, and someone has to keep the greed in check.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would just say it's the cantrip format, and it's like the most consistent streamlined decks that you can have, but you need, to your point, things that can punish them.
That's the ultimate expression of let them eat cake. Like my opponent played a 2/2 for two. I played a brainstorm, like this peasant.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
I am not affecting the board. I am sculpting my hand and I am happy about it.
They'll get me for about 6 damage before I find an answer. Thank you very much. I'm disgusted that you would even try to play this on curve creature.
The insolence.
Yeah, and like kind of wrapping back to Rich's article and these like changing heuristics is all of this, I want to sit on my cantrips and like wait to get value from them to make sure I'm getting like an optimal brainstorm or like pondering later down the road. It's like, no, you need to start affecting the board again. And like the cards are too powerful and you're going to fall behind with cantrips sitting in your hand. So there's a bit of a tension here. But again, going back to Lawrence's point about how decks are now incentivized to play like 6 Force of Wills, for example, or 6 Forces, because they need to stop that thing so that they can continue to dirtle and sculpt their hand rather than like having some kind of effective thing or to then turn around and play their Dreadhorde or Oko or whatever it is. But that's, they kind of like dovetailed nicely together in a way. It comes back to the final point though, like Jeff, like what are your thoughts with Force Negation? Like I think Force of Will is something that I'd always love to continue seeing in the format, but giving more decks like the option to go up to 8 Force of Wills or Force Effects.
I am definitely the worst person to have any opinion on this. I honestly can't say, because like I could have random feelings about what I think for the format, and you know, it doesn't feel great to have that kind of consistent free counters outside of the like aggressive nature of them or not. But as for like my actual like gameplay experience, like, you know, I'm playing almost no non-creature spells. So
did you honestly, say non-creatures or magic? I could have sworn you said no magic, but
gotta keep the storm count going. you know, when I'm playing Magic, typically Force of Negation, like, I don't care. I'd rather somebody have Force of Negation than Force of Will. So I really can't give an informed or intelligent opinion on if it's good or not. It doesn't feel good to have that, but it'd be interesting to see it outside of, you know, the current situation we're in.
I think your point about when we were talking about that triumvirate of like Miracles, D&T, Delver, and your point of like the games were so different when I had turn one Aether Vial, to the point of like, hey, my opponent has a 50% increased amount of forces to stop my turn one Aether Vial. Theoretically, should say, I would expect you to be saying like, I don't like it and I would rather them have less, but.
So pedestrian.
I'm fine.
They also don't have counterbalance anymore, right?
Yeah,
I mean, you can play counterbalance, but not countertop.
The thing with that circumstance too, McBain, is like, if like I can't imagine outside of game one they'd have them in. So like, you know, if they're gonna 2-for-1 themselves, like I'd rather have the vial, but it's honestly not that bad. Like in a deck that's all about finding the card advantage wherever you can get it. Sometimes you are just like, yes, force my spell, please.
Yeah, I know. You know, you're actually right that in the sideboard games, they probably go down to none of them because D&D plays no good cards, so you don't have to keep them in.
Sorry. But I think that's the perversion of the format where, like, sure, like, I think, you know, traditionally you would be like, yeah, I board out these things against D&T. They have good cards in a way.
I was going to say, like, we picked a bad example.
But, you know, you put cards together to make them good. Like, that's the point of D&T. And that's how it punishes, you know, these decks who are like, I'm the answer deck, where you're like, great.
Hang on, I got to write that down.
Like, I have, like, redundancy. I have, like, different angles of attack. Mm. And I have mana efficiency. And then I'm also attacking your mana efficiency at the same time. And that's what makes this deck good. And I think the thing that has changed is that the decks that are the I'm the answer deck, and, like, you know, because of that, D&T is this weird access that I'm like, oh, you're not going to play some Haymaker, and I get rid of the Haymaker, and then I turn the corner. You know, like, it's hard to turn the corner against D&T sometimes. The problem is that, like, now these decks are like, oh, like, you know, I'll just force this file. And, like, yeah, you could need a little bit of card advantage, but then you can just slam an Uro.
And I'm just going to gain 9 life and draw a card.
Yeah. And then eventually I'm just going to kill you. And, like, threats from a legacy perspective, like, I mean, I don't want to speak to a Magic perspective, so maybe there's good reasons for them to put these cards into, like, standard formats. But from a legacy perspective, like, blue shouldn't have good threats. Like, we just joked about all the shitty cards that people were playing while they were simultaneously playing the best card selection spells and the most powerful counter spells that were available. They had these, like, you know, there's like a, like, one of the decks is playing Manowar.
Mm-hmm.
Because that tempo advantage at the time was like, oh, I'm going to bounce your big thing, and then it comes back down and I'm going to counterspell it, and I have a mana advantage over you, and that's how I eke this out. Like, that to me is interesting Magic.
Yeah. Don't you trash that good Jellyfish boy.
You stay
I love Manowar. Don't tell Marshall Sutcliffe on me. I want
to
be.
I was going to say, like, books. Marshall's going to be pissed when he listens to this.
I'm in no books of his right now. He has no
idea. We're never getting him on.
If he ever knows, I want him to know that I respect and love Manowar. It's the purest Magic card. If Manowar were playable, I'd also be happy. Manowar is so fucking far from playable at a 3-drop spot, though. It's a joke. And I don't think that's good. Blue should not have, like, Uro. Uro could probably exist in different colors, like, it couldn't because of the color buy, but, you know, like, that level of threat can exist. And if you want to warp your deck as a blue deck around playing those two not blue colors, I think that's still healthy. But the fact that it's blue and adjacent color means that, like, there's going to be a problem. That was a problem with Death Rite too. The Death Rite was actually a blue card. It came down off Fenagrancy.
Ban dual lands.
Ban fetches. Make everybody own like 12 dual lands.
We can get Phil on this podcast and he will talk about ban fetches and I'll be with him.
Oh my God. That man can rant. So overall, I think these are two fun, interesting articles. I really like the way that Lawrence writes. He has a fun kind of like way of kind of making his points and then also just adding in little nuances along the way.
It's very like informed conversational. Like it's great.
Yeah, he very much has like he's precise in kind of how he's writing. Rich has a bit more of like a string of thought maybe, but again, I find his opinions really interesting and informative. The two heuristics of like I'd hate to lose with Brainstorm in my hand or executing a game plan proactively is the most effective strategy in many cases. Probably that second one could be trimmed down a little bit or simplified as a heuristic, but overall I had a lot of good takeaways from both articles. I would kind of like refer, like we don't need to talk about them, but last March, almost a year ago now, back at the start of the pandemic, Reed Duke was doing a series on like Intro to Legacy, and he kind of did like one on like how to pick your deck, how to get into Magic or how to get into Legacy. And then he did one on like Delver and Graveyard decks and all this, but there was one on cantrips and it talks specifically about like the instances of like why you want to do what when. And it had a number of the points that Rich and Lawrence had talked about. And then there was another article by Javier Dominguez. Is that right, Dominguez?
Javier. I think Dominguez Javier. Is right.
Who had a phenomenal article that really just like summed everything up and some more. So we can link those in the show notes, and really between all four of them, you'll have a great, informed, amazing opinion that will be superior to Jeff's.
Well, I was going to say, you know, I have opinions based on reading all those, and I don't know if they're good yet. So surely anybody else can do better than me.
I still don't know if my opinions are good, but I say that I'm going to bi-weekly basis regardless. I think Rich's point, and I guess he, like as McBain, you pointed out, like Reed kind of like said that too earlier this year, that you should treat decks in the way you would treat combo decks. I don't think that's good. I'm biased. I think it's good combo decks exist, but I'm also not upset when I'm playing some like degenerate combo deck and it gets just like railroaded because my opponent, you know, like knew how to sequence their hand and like played counter spells, and then eventually like I died to, you know, the indignity of dying to like two Snapcasters. And I guess to each of their own, to me that's good Magic, that's what I deserved. But there's other things that happen now where you're like, oh, I slammed a Chalice and like you're at game one and like, well, I guess I got this, and your opponent plays an Oko and you're like, really? Like, yeah. You're supposed to give me game two and three, and that's what I deserve, but I didn't deserve this.
Yeah, I think just like maybe taking a side piece to this whole continued band, what might change things discussion. I think there's like this house of cards, but at the foundation is Oko and the flexibility that it gives these decks to not have to respect certain elements. And because you're not having to respect some of the hate that can affect you, you can then get, like, people are calling for, like, Dreadhorde to be banned. Dreadhorde dies to literally everything. It's a 1/3. It doesn't really give a clock. Like, all of the efficient removal kill it.
There's a lot of faces shared here between Quinn and I against what's being said.
But again, if you're not able to... Like if you've got a Thalia down and like your Dreadhorde can't really do anything, or if you've got a Chalice in play and your Dreadhorde can't do anything, like there's so many things.
It's a 1/3 it can block.
That's true. I'm not gonna. Also,
you just play an extra mana through the Thalia.
Easy.
And then you kill the Thalia.
Step aside, Dan.
With your lightning bolt that you flash back after you killed the mom on turn one.
But to me, it does go back to like I would rather see the foundation of like Oko taken out first. That would allow other decks to really kind of punish things.
I think that's so heavy, right? That the flexibility of Oko is the thing that makes it enemy number one.
Flexibility, unkillability, or like the difficulty for a lot of decks to deal with it. And then all of these like really weird interactions where like whenever you've gotten like the swap going on, like the -5 swap, like that's when you're like, this card's busted. I can't believe this. Like, there's definitely been a couple games that I've won where like you're kind of like analyzing the board state with Rugdelver. You're like, oh, okay. Oh yeah, I've got this swap thing. I'll just do this and they're dead. Oh yeah, great. God, I remember that.
Would you like a food?
Take a flip Delver. It's fine.
Yeah. Let me interest you in this thing.
Or the first time you realize you don't have to pay for a tabernacle on your food elk.
Yeah.
If the tabernacle was in play before.
Having played lands, I've definitely wastelanded my own tabernacle and brought it back. And then wastelanded their lands. I'm like, now your elks can get out of here. But yeah. And again, like going back, like with stronger hate or like hate allowing to actually do things, like I think Uro gets worse. I think like everything gets a little bit worse, all of the more problematic cards that we see. And I would prefer to see that first rather than like keeping all the power really high, the hate low, and then kind of trying to chip things off the top. You're like, oh, I don't like Uro, it's really good in this instance, or I don't like Veil of Summer, it's really good in this instance. It's like I'd rather just like make the other side of the metagame, the non-blue decks, I'd rather just make those better. Mm-hmm. Try to improve it that way.
So my pledge, and I'm gonna just, sorry, Jeff, against maybe against your will, I'm gonna loop you into this. Jeff and I will not respond to this, McBain. But do you think that there needs to be a change in legacy based on what's happening in the last, 6 months?
So I actually pinned a note on my Twitter, my whatever, at Servant Painter, I remember it, Twitter bio. I pinned a note trying to do Ian Duke's job for him and just said, here's the memo, as if I was Ian Duke, and therefore Oko's banned. So I think there could easily be a change, and what I would hope for would be Oko to be banned. That would be...
We've entered 2021, and I just want to say to all our friends that they're listening, we fucking got him. We finally got him on board. We did it.
And until then, I will continue to have fun and play Rick Dover.
God, you're an awful person.
Yeah, I respect... Everyone has fun a different way, and some people's fun is playing cards that are obviously very powerful and just destroying other people. And McBain, if there's one thing I know about you, it's that you love doing that, and I respect the hell out of it. I'm just saying, we got him. Jeff, we got him. On this high note for Jeff and I, why don't we take it home with a segment we like to call That's Gas, where we're going to build on this positive with more positives. Jeff, I'm going to ask you first. Who's gas?
All right. Always gas, always positive. Dugs on Twitch, owner of greensunzenith.com, Maverick Monthly, all kinds of content put out all the time, almost always Maverick related. But my favorite thing that he does is the monthly newsletters for Maverick. It's awesome to see just pure dedication to, I mean, this is in so many schools of Legacy, but pure dedication to like one archetype and one deck, and getting a monthly article or newsletter talking about like the people that top eight at different events, the differences between their lists, why these sideboard choices are relevant, different cards to maybe try, different things like on the watch list you want to look at. Like, it's so cool to read that. And I love really reading anything with like that kind of passion people bring to it, where they're like, they are invested in this. They're writing this because they're excited about it. It's a very cool thing to read all the time. A great website to look at. Some very cool sweaters and mugs for sale, and frequently streaming on Twitch. And I believe he has not missed a single one of our own Twitch streams, which is very impressive.
They're painful. So respect.
I don't know how long he stayed around for, but he at least popped in the chat.
If it's more than 10 seconds, I respect the hell of it. I want to do. I don't want to tempt fate. So if you're an asshole who plays Maverick, please don't contact me. But I've never met a Maverick player that I don't love. Never in my life. Yeah. Think about it. Jeff's thinking about it. He's trying to think of someone. While Jeff is maybe still trying to think of someone who plays Maverick that he doesn't like, and I think he's going to have a problem, McBain, tell us about someone who you do like.
I'm going to That's Gas Andrew Walker. And this is the gentleman who's putting on this pre-modern monthly tournaments. I know I'd been doing a number of old school tournaments over the last few months in 2020. And honestly, I tried to put in like pretty low effort, but it's still quite a bit of work. But in January, I joined this pre-modern one. I was like, this pre-modern thing looks pretty fun. I get to play with Gush and Daze. What's not to love? And I joined in, and like, it was like this giant Google Doc, and it was just like the most well run event for like 200 people or whatever joining and playing. They've got like a little like Google form thing to submit your match results and things like that. Like, I had concerns about playing a larger pod form of an online event. And I was like, oh, I have to like contact people and schedule things. Like, oh, this is like a lot of work. I don't know. And honestly, like the system that Andrew has set up, and I'm sure some people helping him, is just phenomenal. And it really takes a lot of the kind of work out of the people who are playing in the event to kind of go around and organize things. Like, you get set up in your pod, the doc and like the form is very, very well laid out, very organized. It's very clear of like what everyone's game wins percentage is. You're not going in and messing with things. It's all automated on the back end. And then you're set up with like a little messenger chat of all the people who you're playing. So you can just kind of like chat with each other and organize things. Hey, when are you around? You see when other people are on, and like, there's been times where I'm just like, hey, I've got like a free hour. Like, let me know when you're done and I'll play you as well. And it's been really fun for an online like monthly thing. And I haven't done like a big one like that. I don't know if like the New England old school things are like that, or if there's a legacy one going on, but I'm pretty blown away with like how efficiently and simply it was run. We'll see if I win my pod, who knows, but I had a lot of fun playing it. And I have to like really, like it takes me back, like playing some of these cards and seeing some of these cards. Like, again, I played back with like Urza Saga and Masks Block and Invasions. Like those were like prime type 2 days for me. So I have a special place in my heart for those cards. And like seeing the Dazes and Gushes and like your entire deck being old border cards. I forgot what old border cards were. Like, even though in like Legacy and stuff, I play primarily old border, like seeing only old border cards is just something. It's just gorgeous.
I'm waiting on an order from Face to Face from the Boxing Day sale. And I was like, the Dazes I have are all new Dazes. I got to buy some Neversis Dazes.
It's so good. Like, there's a few cards
in my deck. I can give you Nemesis Dazes.
Already bought them. Waiting on them to show up.
Okay. I upgraded Japanese, so I can give you 4 English ones, but.
Like, I was playing the number of peaks in my deck. Like, I only had like one old border peak, so I had like 3 new border ones. And just like the blue, like, you don't get that like kind of like wavy blue in the frame. The letters are all bolded and like shadowed and everything. I was just like, I want to burn this card, like get it out of here. Like the old border stuff just looks so gorgeous. And the lands too. Oh man.
Well, just mana drain. Ugh. New mana drain. Don't like it.
Well,
old mana drain, not even an iconic piece of art, but just the border. I just like, you know, it just looks so much nicer.
Those Odyssey frames are like, that's my magic right there.
Well, yeah. And Odyssey, like, you can very much be playing like the blue green kind of werebear, nimble mongoose, mental note, gush days, piles of garbage. Like, that's very much a thing. It was. we talked about it like a dozen episodes ago, pre-modern. You can play it online. I was playing on paper and webcam. It's a boatload of fun, and big shout outs to Andrew Walker for putting this on. I know it's a lot of work.
I think you mentioned it already, even just in that, but how many people are in this event right now?
I honestly don't know the full number. It's like, there's like 7 to 8 person pods, and it goes from like pod A to pod like N or M or something like that. Like it's a good chunk of people.
That's very cool.
Again, you get to see like all the people who are playing, and the doc like automatically summarizes, and it's like, in this pod, this person's in the lead, and like here overall, all the pods put together, like here's who is in the lead. So you get that like automatic update going on. Again, just like, you're not doing it the way everything's set up. It just kind of automatically does it. It's really well done, and it feels like you're kind of at a GP, and every once in a while you get a round call, and you just go over, you play around, and then you go on with your day. But I'm sure there's other formats that are like it. But again, I've been really enjoying it. And again, just playing pre-modern, where there's no planeswalkers, there's no big bomby things. Like, my opponent played, like, he's like, they went Dark Ritual Phyrexian Arena. And I was like, oh no, this is awful. Like, they're just going to draw 2 cards every turn. And I slowly died. But it's been
when we can finally see each other in person again. McBain, I think you'll love the cube that I finally finished, because there are no planeswalkers. Flametongue Cabu, I think, is like a legitimate, you know,
beautiful
top 7 pick, kind of first half of the pack pick.
Nice.
All of our friends are in the cube. I'm going to finish the last Take Us Home. I can't believe we haven't done this, but I want to just That's Gas the Connection, which is another local game. So we talk a lot about Magic Stronghold, which I think is the store we go to most often on a weekly basis in non-pandemic times. But the Connection, another like big supporter of Legacy. I think we've mentioned the Harry Wong Classic in the past, and so they're the hosts of that, and also like a monthly, one of the few monthly proxy Legacy tournaments, which is like also a great way to get people to come out who have maybe not tried Legacy as much. So, you know, big supporters of the format. Matt, who's the owner of the store, was one of Harry's best friends. And so he has a huge personal connection to Legacy, is really carrying the torch for Harry, which I think is just like incredible to see. And so just like shout out to them. If you're in Vancouver, another place for you to pick up cards, if you're looking, I would highly recommend it. And
they've got a lot of good product there, like a lot of selection.
Yeah. Also like tons of old school video games. If you were into like still playing Nintendo 64 or SNES, like I am, that's the place to go, I think.
Yeah, I've definitely picked up a couple old games.
I don't think there's anything else. So waving the magic wand here. Jeff, where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter at JeffDKK.
McBain, you already said where you're on Twitter, but I'm going to keep talking a little longer. Maybe you'll forget it. Where can people find you?
On Twitter at @servantpainter.
Ooh, long pause. I think we almost got him. I'm on Twitter at Quinn O'Mori, and we're all on Twitter at Canadian Thresh. Sometimes on Twitch at the Canadian Threshold. Is that right?
I believe so.
I'm putting this out there right now, Jeff, because I know you're a busy man, even during the lockdown. But we have access to all the cards, which means we should stream some nonsense, I think.
I like this. I like this idea.
I think we're required. We're required to stream nonsense.
I just want to say, too, we are also available. Questions, comments, concerns, thecanadianthreshold@gmail.com. Yes. That forwards now to my inbox myself, so nobody has to log in and check it, so I should respond pretty quick. And it would be a great error to not mention our number one patron and fan, Jack Vanilla. Thank you for all of the comments and emails you send.
That's gassed Jack, right? We have.
I think so, a couple times. Can we do a collective three-way That's Gassed right here?
Yeah, like 100%. If we miss one, like this is like a travesty. Yeah.
But we do get, I know we like, I'm always surprised at like the feedback that we do get. We don't talk about it very much on the show. Some other podcasts like always start off with their feedback and this and that. We do read them all. We do love and appreciate all of them. So to the people who do send them in, don't think that it just kind of goes into the Gmail inbox that Jeff never checks. That doesn't happen at all.
We're happily shocked every single time, just for the record.
Oh, yeah. So I share everything we get on Reddit or in the email, and you know, we all talk about it. It's a good time and appreciate it for sure.
Yeah, like if you do have any comments about like how Peak's actually a real card, or like why Dooms playing Doomsday and why Mentor Top is like really the same deck, like you can send those to us. But again, we do read them and appreciate them. So thank you.
Anything else before we let everyone go? The silence I'm going to take is no. Thank you so much for listening. As always, everybody, we'll see you in 2 thresholds.
Hold on for one more play.